Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Prepare ye the way of the Lord. Prepare ye the way of the Lord.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. On this feast of the birth of St. John the Baptist, the cousin of Jesus and the one who prepared the way for Jesus' ministry, we also remember that Jesus asked Peter, "Who do you say that I am?" Peter's response was everything for which John the Baptist had dreamed and prepared. Today we will reflect on the question that Jesus posed, not only to Peter, but to each one of us, and for all time. Jesus asks each one of us the same question, and in receiving the Eucharist we make our own response. In his recent apostolic exhortation Sacramentum Caritatis, Pope Benedict points out that although the basic content of the words of Jesus do not alter, they must be rephrased for each generation. In today's programme, we take a look at Eucharistic belief and expression in the Church. First, however, Jill Bevilacqua and Sean Patrick Lovett reflect on a very special gospel and remember Peter's response to Jesus.
One day when Jesus was praying in seclusion and his disciples were with him, he put the question to them, "Who do the crowd say that I am?" "John the Baptizer," they replied, "and some say Elijah, while others claim that one of the prophets of old has returned from the dead." "But you, who do you say that I am?" he asked them. Peter said in reply, "The Messiah of God." He strictly forbade them to tell this to anyone. "The Son of Man," he said, "must first endure many sufferings, be rejected by the elders, the high priests, and the scribes, and be put to death, and then be raised up on the third day." Jesus said to all, "Whoever wishes to be my follower must deny his very self, take up his cross each day, and follow in my steps. Whoever would save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake will save it."
Many are the occasions referred to in the Gospels when we're told that Jesus took himself off alone to pray. This time, although he's praying in seclusion, he's not alone. His disciples are with him. Another version reads, "He was praying alone in the presence of his disciples." It might sound confusing, and yet what Luke seems to be telling us is that Jesus and his disciples are in a secluded spot, away from the usual crowds. Jesus has not gone off on his own this time, however, but has taken the disciples with him. We're not told if they are praying too. The evangelists never seem to mention this, though we know they asked Jesus to teach them to pray. Why did Jesus take them with him this time? The answer is surely in the question he puts to them, the second question, "Who do you say that I am?" If we turn to the Gospels of Matthew and Mark, we're given a fuller account of what happened on that occasion. Not only did Peter answer the question by acknowledging the divinity of Christ, but he was promised the keys of the kingdom. For such an event, we can hardly call it an episode, there was very good reason to withdraw to a place where the crowds were unlikely to follow them. Jesus may well have been waiting for a suitable opportunity for some time. Shortly before, Luke writes that they withdrew to a town called Bethsaida, where they could be by themselves, but the crowds got to know, and they went after him. And Luke recounts then the feeding of the 5,000. Bethsaida, which was Peter's hometown, was situated on the north of Lake Galilee, a little to the east of the point where the River Jordan enters the lake. Mark tells of the cure of a blind man at Bethsaida, just before the event we're considering. And both he and Matthew give us a piece of information Luke omits. They tell us where it happens. Writes Mark,
"Jesus and his disciples left for the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way he put this question to his disciples, 'Who do people say I am?'"
Matthew says briefly,
"When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he put this question to his disciples, 'Who do people say the Son of Man is?'"
There's no exact spot we can pinpoint, but it was near or on the way to Caesarea Philippi, the great pagan city some 40 kilometres to the north. If they went all the way, it would have taken them a couple of days at least, following the course of the Jordan, almost to its source in the foothills of Mount Hermon. Or rather, two of its sources, a third comes from Lebanon. It was the summer of the year 29, it seems, July probably, their last summer together. 9 months later would come the events which would change all their lives forever. As yet, the apostles were blissfully unaware of the future. But Jesus had to begin preparing them. So as on other significant occasions, he took them away to a place where there would be no towns, no crowds, no wrangling scribes and Pharisees, just themselves. The countryside they were now approaching was much wilder than that of their familiar lakeside.
Hard mountain country, with sudden wide vistas into distant valleys and glimpses ahead of hills and volcanic cliffs of black basalt.
So writes a traveller. The road they're travelling now is a frontier road with ahead the mountains of Syria. Dominating the skyline are the massive peaks of Mount Hermon, almost always covered with snow, even in summer, as it was now. The mountain range of Hermon, over 20 miles in length, is a landmark all over Syria and Palestine.
Vine and olive and mulberry trees grow halfway up its slopes, but after 5,000 feet the bare rock piles itself into fantastic ridges, heaped above terrible chasms, the haunt of eagles, wolves and mountain bears.
What sort of impression would this harsh, rugged landscape have made on the little group of men used to such a different kind of countryside? But then they would have seen something else. An amazing vision would have risen up before them, the splendid pagan city of Caesarea Philippi.
The city nestled in a beauty of marble columns and running water among the thick woods of the lowest slopes of Hermon. In all Palestine and Syria, there was no more lovely site for a city. In the hills at the back was a dark grotto in which one of the sources of the Jordan welled up from the earth to rush, sparkling in the sunlight, through the city to the plain. The Greeks had called the place Paneas because such grottos were always sacred to the god Pan. Herod the Great had adorned Paneas with a temple to the Emperor Augustus. When Philip the Tetrarch inherited this exquisite spot in the year of Christ's birth, he built there a city which he called Caesarea in honor of the Emperor Tiberius, adding his own name to distinguish it from the city of Caesarea on the sea coast.
Perhaps, as our traveller notes, of all the adventures this place has suffered, none is stranger than that of its name. When he was there in the 1930s, he found only a tangle of briars and a huddle of mud houses. The name was once more Paneas, but because there is no P in their alphabet, the Arabs had called it Baneas. Baneas it is today. Only times must have changed, for as the guidebook tells us, it is now a major tourist attraction with pleasant surroundings, important remnants of the past and many local amenities. Let's hear H.V. Morton's conclusion, as surrounded by briars and hovels, he imagines the city as Jesus and the apostles saw it.
In Roman times, the city must have been one of the finest in the country. The sound of running water enlivened its streets. Even on the hottest summer day, the pale green, melted snow water went rushing through them into the valley. And today, the tumultuous sources of the Jordan leap out from the roots of Hermon and go singing over the dead body of Caesarea Philippi.
The great city is no more. The place has regained its ancient name. But throughout the centuries there has been one constant presence, water, the spring of the River Hermon, which issues from the Grotto of Pan, source of the River Jordan, together with a number of small waterfalls. And this is surely what draws the tourists. But there's another element, rock, for all this is on the rock escarpment above the town. And as Jesus and his disciples approached, what they would have seen first would have been Herod's temple, perched high on the rock, which was visible for miles around. And what is one of the sights shown to visitors? A spot above the rock escarpment believed to be where Peter received the keys to the kingdom of heaven. This, of course, we know to be not quite exact, as on that occasion Peter was only promised the keys. But it was then that Jesus said to him, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." As far as we know, Jesus and his disciples never visited the glittering city in the foothills of Mount Hermon. Like Tiberias, it was pagan and therefore unclean. But from Matthew's Gospel, we know that they were in the area, and that this was probably the northernmost point they ever reached. The Hermon mountain range marked the northern limit of the conquests of Moses and Joshua, while a little way to the east of today's Banias is Dan. When the Israelite tribe of Dan took the Canaanite city of Laish, they renamed it. And the phrase, "from Dan even to Beersheba," described the biblical Israelite territory. Not that this was such a great distance, as our traveller comments.
A man in a good car can breakfast on the ruined hill of Dan under the Lebanons and eat his evening meal beside the wells of Abraham on the desert plain around Beersheba in the south.
And today he could probably even be there by lunchtime. All these details seem to point to one thing, that our Lord chose to go to the extreme limits of the territory of the Old Testament to speak to his disciples of the founding of the New and of what it would entail. The answers given to his first question show how deeply rooted people were in the idea of a returned prophet. Some said he was John the Baptist, who'd been killed by Herod less than 6 months earlier, and the memory of whom would have been fresh in their minds. Others believed he must be Elijah or one of the prophets. Matthew's version also mentions Jeremiah. Perhaps we need to clarify our ideas on what exactly a prophet is or was. Usually we mean the prophets who wrote the prophetic books of the Bible, four of whom are known as the major prophets, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and, yes, Jeremiah. Major because their writings are more extensive. And then there are a dozen or so minor ones. Jeremiah was specially noted for his calls for moral reform and his prophecies of the fall of Jerusalem to Babylon. But he's had rather a bad press because of his Lamentations, which treat of the destruction of the holy city. So that people whom today we call prophets of doom used to be called Jeremiahs for their doleful visions of the future. The only other prophet mentioned by name here is Elijah, who doesn't seem to have written anything. But then a prophet is one who speaks for God as the inspired revealer or interpreter of his will. Or in another definition, a person who utters divinely inspired revelations, which comes to the same thing. But prophets not only write and speak, they act. And Elijah was protagonist of a famous contest on the heights of Mount Carmel when he brought down fire from heaven and confounded the priests of Baal. He was what we might call an elemental prophet. He predicted a drought, and a drought there was, neither dew nor rain. 3 years later he said, "I hear the sound of rain," and told his servant to go and look out to the sea. And after going 7 times, the man returned, saying, "Now there is a cloud, small as a man's hand, rising from the sea." And before long we read, "The sky drew dark with cloud and storm, and rain fell in torrents." But surely the most atmospheric of these events was Elijah's encounter with God on Mount Horeb, the same mountain of God where Moses had crouched in a crevice of the rock while Yahweh passed by. Elijah spent the night in that same cave and then was told by God to come out and stand on the mountain.
Then Yahweh himself went by. There came a mighty wind, so strong it tore the mountains and shattered the rocks before Yahweh. But Yahweh was not in the wind. After the wind came an earthquake, but Yahweh was not in the earthquake. After the earthquake came a fire, but Yahweh was not in the fire. And after the fire there came the sound of a gentle breeze. And when Elijah heard this, he covered his face with his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. Then a voice came to him.
That still, small voice, which has been so often quoted, the voice of God. And a biblical scholar writes,
"The phrase, the sound of a gentle breeze, is a translation, following the old versions, of a Hebrew phrase formed in paradoxical manner, Col de mamma d'acqua, voice of a gentle silence. In this way, through an apparent contradiction, for silence has no voice, the biblical author seeks to express the depth of the divine mystery. Whereas on Carmel, God revealed himself in a powerful way, by fire, here he reveals himself in silence. By this revelation, the prophet Elijah learns that the Lord is close to his faithful, not only by means of great prodigies, but also in the everyday quality of human experience, which seems wrapped only in God's silence.
The man who was fed by ravens in the wilderness and who was carried up to heaven in a chariot of fire in the midst of a whirlwind might not seem to have known the everyday quality of human experience. But he was a prophet and must make God known, and his miracles, we're told, anticipated those Jesus worked as proofs of his messianic mission. Elijah is considered the prophet of prophets. He was seen by the apostles at the Transfiguration together with Moses. He was to come again before the Last Judgment. Why, the apostles asked Jesus. To see that everything is once more as it should be, he told them. But he also referred to John the Baptist when he said,
I tell you that Elijah has come already, and they did not recognize him, but treated him as they pleased, and the Son of Man will suffer similarly at their hands.
Here, at Caesarea Philippi, a week before the Transfiguration, Jesus is already speaking of his passion and death, but also of his resurrection, though the evangelists do not record a reaction of the apostles to this. Only in Matthew and Mark, Peter's remonstrance, Heaven preserve you, Lord, this must not happen to you, and our Lord's terrible reply, Get behind me, Satan. The last paragraph of today's Gospel seems to include other people, not just the 12. Jesus said to all, we heard. Mark is more specific. He called the people and his disciples to him. The old Vulgate version goes so far as to say, and calling the multitude together with his disciples. Matthew alone writes simply, Then Jesus said to his disciples. So maybe they had left their secluded spot and were out, so to speak, in the open once more. The next great event, the Transfiguration, was to take place within the week. Some believe it may have happened on Mount Hermon, in which case they were almost there. But tradition has always set it on Mount Tabor, which was days away, well down to the southwest of Lake Galilee, in which case they would now turn their backs on the great and glorious city, on Herod's shining temple, on rocks and waterfalls, and retracing their steps, go southwards once more. The words our Lord spoke next suggest that the crowds are forming again, and foreseeing that there will be those who will declare their desire to follow him, he makes it clear immediately that discipleship does not mean an easy life, and he states the conditions.
Whoever wishes to be my follower must deny his very self, take up his cross each day, and follow in my steps.
And those steps were already leading to Jerusalem and the cross.
The recent apostolic exhortation, Sacramentum Caritatis, acts as a springboard for further growth and understanding. Father Richard Taylor tells us more.
St. Augustine rightly says in a famous sermon that the new man sings a new song. Singing is an expression of joy, and if we consider the matter, an expression of love. The people of God assembled for the liturgy sings the praises of God.
The The song of God's praise is dynamic. As the years roll onwards, it is sung in changing cultures, in many languages, and in a vast range of situations. Also, as the years pass by, the understanding of the gospel message grows and develops. Although the basic content of the words of Jesus do not alter, they must be rephrased for each generation, so that, within its own context, the ancient song of praise might always be fresh and available to the people of God. Father Richard Taylor teaches New Testament studies and the biblical foundations of theology at the Pontifical Beda College and at the Angelicum University in Rome. He points out that whereas the apostolic exhortation Sacramentum Caritatis talks about the Eucharistic belief and expression in the Church of today, it also acts as a springboard for further growth and understanding.
What he does do in that is to accentuate the high points of liturgical service. So, as he does himself here in Rome, when he is presiding at the Mass, with the magnificence, the splendour that makes up the Vatican celebrations, he's asking that the local ordinaries everywhere make their celebrations something similar, so that when people would see the diocese at prayer in the pontifical mass presided over by the bishop, this would become the paradigm case, the example, which would in fact be the norm for the parish priest and other priests when they, in their own way, in obviously a much more reduced way as far as music and so on would go, at least that there are these norms, these points, which are there all the time, and that this would be a major concern of every bishop. In other words, celebrating the Mass and celebrating the Mass in a way that is consonant with the principles that are being articulated here. So there's a feeling of, as you say, a dynamism about it, that what he is doing here and what people like, what they see, and what they most appreciated when it went right across the televisions of the world, they could see something really beautiful. Now, he said, that is what he would like people to be able to do wherever they celebrate the Mass, in their own cathedrals and then in their own parish churches and chapels. He doesn't want even the shortage of priests or the lack of very often means to diminish the quality of the service. And so he's exhorting, it's an exhortation, he's exhorting people to use seriously the tradition that's available and to develop it as much as they can.
So it comes back again to the seminaries. So how are the seminaries going to implement this?
See, the seminary has got to be obviously a place where the quality of education and the quality of taste will be developed as well. In other words, a seminary is a place for people who want to be leaders of the people of God, and therefore people who should have a great sense of reverence and a great sense of devotion. But there is a great pressure on seminarians, and very often the seminaries in our first world these days are short of people. So the choirs and organists and so on that were there in the past are not there in the same way now. And it means that for us, we were young and had the High Mass on a Sunday morning. It was a magnificent occasion with hundreds of people singing marvellous music with a terrific choice. That's not possible now. So there is obviously an onus, a great onus, to do the best with what one has got, but realism must be there. Also, when you're asking small numbers of people who are in the seminaries to do an awful lot of things over and above the basic studies, it's not easy to do them very well. So learning Latin, for instance. In our day, we went to the seminary knowing Latin, and it's a different world. We went up from parishes where we were singing plain chant, whereas many people have never heard plain chant before. And so you would imagine that choir masters in the seminary in our day, I mean, they were superlative. These days, sometimes, I was in one seminary, we had no organist. Then we didn't have anybody who really knew music well enough to be a leader, a cantor. So these are factors. We've got to be reasonable about what you can ask of seminarians and ask of seminary staffs. But what you could ask for, or must ask for, is that devotion and reverence and care and respect, that these are maximal, and that anyone who wants to be a priest should never, ever be seen to be short on these aspects.
Because without the Eucharist, the Church doesn't exist.
The Eucharist is the Church visible at prayer, isn't it? And that's where everything the Church is about is celebrated, where it is preached, where all our hopes and aspirations are expressed. And the encyclical draws out the social implications of the Eucharist. Remember, he's thinking about the nature of helping those in need, the ecumenical dimension. He's very careful about it. Mm. Once again, very fascinating the way it's presented, not in any sense condemning, shall we say, excesses which obviously exist here and there, rather saying we know the norms, use them maximally and help people who belong to other churches and communions, ecclesial communions, to be able to celebrate with us in the way that is consonant with the way in which the Catholic Church understands the Eucharist. So it's very positive. Mm.
Yes, because that struck me as well. When he refers to the Orthodox, for instance, where we still have some little differences between the Roman Church and the Eastern Church, he's very sensitive in presenting their understanding as well.
That's right. You see, another demand that he's making upon priests and seminarians is that they actually should assist at and know something of the Orthodox rites. Of course, that is not easy for a whole lot of people, but nowadays, because of immigration, it's becoming almost a necessity. But the notion of the hands-on approach comes out of this exhortation. It isn't just a document that you just read. You're being constantly asked to do things. And therefore, when you're engaged in ecumenism, that's not just a question of ideas. It's a question of meeting and being with and praying with our separated brothers and sisters. And when you're with the Orthodox, once again, not to be a total stranger to their services or to be surprised at the way in which they might find that our services might not correspond to their cultural background and so on. So there's a whole sort of invitation in this for people to see the implications of the Eucharist at every level.
Yes, it's not just an intellectual exercise.
Not at all, no.
And so we come to the end of our programme for today. You can hear it all again in whole or in its parts if you go to our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. I'm Sister Janet Ferns. Until we meet again, may God bless you.
This is the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.